Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminati Namani Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharani Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pasyatya Deshatarani Trinadapi Sunichena Taradiva Sahishnuna Amanina Manadena Kirtaniya Sadahari Harenama Harenama Harenamai Vikivalam Kalau Nastyeva 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 Gatir Anyata Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivas Adi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. This is a reading from the Mahabharata, or the Greater History of India, Chapter 24, Part 1. Krishna visits the Pandavas. When Krishna heard the news that the Pandavas had been exiled, he decided to go and see them in the forest. He invited Balaram, Drishtadyumna, Shikhandi and many other kings to accompany him, along with Subhadra and her son Abhimanyu. And together they rode to the Kamyaka forest. Seeing Yudhishthira and his brothers dressed in deer skins and stripped of their kingdom, both Balaram and Krishna were outraged. Krishna said, "I cannot tolerate this injustice. The earth shall drink the blood of Duryodhan, Karna, Shakuni, and that fourth one, Dushasan. After we kill them and their followers, we will install Dharmaraj on the throne. Those cunning men deserve to be slain. All this is quite in accord with the eternal morality." Krishna's anger blazed. It seemed as if he were about to consume the contrition. Arjuna quickly sought to pacify him by recollecting his many wonderful deeds. Arjuna said, "O Krishna, the great Rishi Vyasadeva has told me that you are the cause of creation. You are the mover of all minds and the beginning and end of all things. All asceticism rests in you, for you are the embodiment of all sacrifice and are the eternal Supreme Person. All demigods depend upon you, for you are the origin of the universal creator, Brahma. O mighty Arni Keshava, you have appeared many times on earth in so many different incarnations." Accepting Krishna as the cause of even the almighty Vishnu, Arjuna described the various Vishnu avatars. They had appeared in so many past ages. "O Krishna, as Narasingha you slew the mighty Asura Hiranyakashipu. As Aditi son of Vamana, you swept the entire universe with three steps. O soul of all beings, covering the heavens, you dwell in the body of the sun and imbue him with your own effulgence. Arjuna went on to describe Krishna's activities in his present appearance. "My Lord, You have killed numerous demoniac kings. They were fierce enemies of even the demigods. Oh, Janardhan, you have manifest here on earth the sacred and eternal city Dwarka. That city abounds in opulence and is always crowded with rishis. Envy, untruth, malice, and cruelty are absent in you, for you are always the well-wishing friend of all creatures. Sage Narada has told me that at the end of the Yuga, all things mobile and immobile will enter into your body. O Krishna, there is no limit to your glories, for I have spoken of only a minute part. As Arjuna spoke, he felt himself becoming overpowered by transcendental ecstasy. His voice choked up. He was unable to continue. Pleased and pacified by Arjuna's expression of love, Krishna said, Arjuna, you are mine, and I am yours. All that is mine is yours. For one who hates you also hates me. And one who follows you also follows me. Formerly, you were Nara, and I was Narayan. Although we are individuals, we are as one. No one can understand our oneness and difference. Part 2. Draupadi questions Krishna. Draupadi, her dark, beautiful, enhanced by her soft deerskin clothes, came forward with folded palms and said to Krishna, O irrepressible one, all the great rishis have described you as the Supreme Person. The entire universe exists in you, for you are the refuge of all ascetics and sages. Even as children sport with their toys, so do you sport with the celestials. Those seeking your protection are never overcome by calamity. O slayer of demons, how is it then that one like me, the wife of the Pandavas, the sister of Drishtadyumna, and your friend, could have been so insulted by the Kauravas? Draupadi's dark eyes filled with tears as she spoke. Subhadra also wept as she stood with her arm around Draupadi's shoulder. As she recalled the dice game, Draupadi became angry. Why, O Krishna, why? Why did my five powerful husbands sit silently while I was humiliated by wicked men of no importance? Fie upon Bhima's arms and Arjuna's celebrated Gandiva, for they could not protect a woman in distress, not even their wife. Fie upon Bhishma and Dhritarashtra. Although I am their daughter-in-law, they were prepared to see me a slave. Draupadi hid her face with her soft hands. Those hands resembled the buds of the lotus flower. Her shoulders shook as she cried. Regaining her composure after a few moments, she took a deep breath and then concluded, "O Krishna, you are my only shelter. I deserve your protection for four reasons. I deserve your protection because of our family relationship, because of our friendship, because of the respect you bear for me, and because the fact that you are my Lord." Krishna replied, "O fair lady, you will see the wives of those with whom you are angry. You will see them weep as you now weep. When their husbands lie dead on the battlefield, their bodies covered with arrows and weltering in blood. O Draupadi, do not grieve. I shall do for the Pandavas whatever lies within my power. You shall be the queen of kings. I speak the truth. The heavens may fall and the Himalayas may move. The earth may crack and the ocean may dry up. But know for certain, O Draupadi, my words will never prove false." Draupadi was solaced by Krishna's words. She did not doubt that he acted only for her ultimate welfare. The princess glanced across at Arjuna. The warrior replied, "O lotus-eyed lady, do not weep. What Krishna has said will come to pass. It cannot be otherwise." Standing by his sister's side, Drishtadyumna replied, "I shall slay Drona. Our brother Shikhandi will kill Bhishma. Bhima will kill Duryodhan. And Arjuna will kill Karna. For it was Karna who offered you such an unbearable offense in the Sabha. My dear sister, with Ram and Krishna's assistance, even Indra cannot conquer us. What then can be said of Dhritarashtra's sons?" Part 3. Why Krishna was not present at the gambling match. All present now turned again toward Krishna. Looking at Yudhishthira, Krishna said, "O Lord of the earth, had I not been otherwise engaged at the time, I would have personally come to prevent the gambling match. By pointing out the evils associated with gambling, I would have gained the support of Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, and Bhalika. Between us all, we would surely have swayed the blind king from his crooked purpose." All the Brahmins present gathered around to hear Krishna speak, and Krishna glanced at them with affection. Indulgence in illicit sex, gambling, hunting, and intoxication are the four evils which beset men and deprive them of their prosperity. Gambling is particularly marked by the destruction of property, by misfortune, and by the squandering of wealth. It leads only to harsh words and enmity. Krishna then said that he would have pointed this out to Dhritarashtra, and if the king did not listen, Krishna would have used force to bring him to his senses. And if anyone had supported the king in his ignorance, I would have destroyed them all. All this surely would have taken place. O king, if I had not been away from Dwaraka at that time, it was only upon my return that Satyaki informed me of the events in Hastinapur. Immediately upon receiving the news, I came here. My heart is pained to see you all now, overtaken by calamity and sunk into misfortune. Yudhishthir asked Krishna where he had been during the gambling match. Krishna explained that he had gone to do battle with a king named Chalva, who was a friend of Shishupal. When Chalva heard that Krishna had killed Shishupal, he went to Dwaraka and attacked the city, while Krishna was in Indraprastha. Chalva owned a great airship which resembled a flying city. Chalva had received this wonderful airship as a gift from Lord Shiva. In the battle, he used it as a base from which to attack his foes. Raining down weapons of every kind, he then had challenged Krishna, not realizing that Krishna was absent from Dwaraka. After wreaking havoc in Dwaraka, Chalva had returned to his own city. Part 4. Krishna's narration of how he killed Chalva. Because Yudhishthir was interested, Krishna described in detail the fight that had taken place between Chalva and Dwaraka's warriors. He then told the Pandava how, after returning to Dwaraka and hearing of Chalva's attack, Krishna had gone personally to fight with him. A terrible battle then ensued. Chalva had acquired great mystic power through his performance of asceticism. While Chalva was fighting with Krishna, he created an illusion and seemingly killed Krishna's father, Vasudeva, right there on the battlefield. By his mystic power, Chalva also sent showers of arrows, clubs, winged darts, lances, thunderbolts, bullets, rockets, swords, axes, and other weapons. All these rained down upon Krishna and his forces. In the end, Krishna did kill Chalva, and he destroyed his airship with his Sudarshana Chakra. Krishna thus concluded his narration. That is why, O Yudhishthir, I was unable to come to Hastinapur. The dice match took place just after I had slain Chalva, and I was engaged in restoring Dwaraka back to its former condition. If I had come, Duryodhan would not now be alive, and the gambling match would never have taken place. But what can I do now? It is most difficult to stem the tide once the dam is broken. Part 4. Part 5. Markandeya Rishi visits the Pandavas. Krishna then stood up to leave. He could do nothing for the Pandavas until the end of the 13 years. He knew that Yudhishthir and his brothers were too virtuous to break their vow. They would doubtlessly remain in the forest for the entire full period. Krishna therefore told them that he would return to see them at the end of their exile. If Duryodhan did not return their kingdom, he said, then he knew there would be a battle in which the evil Kaurava and his followers would all be annihilated. The Pandavas bade Krishna and his party farewell, and Arjuna especially bid an affectionate goodbye to Subhadra and their young son Abhimanyu. Closely followed by Drishtadyumna and the other monarchs, Krishna left the forest on his golden chariot. That chariot shone like the brilliant sun. As the thunderous sound of the chariot wheels died away into the distance, Yudhishthir ordered his brothers to make ready for their own departure. He wanted to enter more deeply into the Kamyaka forest and find a suitable place where they might spend their exile. Still accompanied by thousands of Brahmins, the brothers made their way into the forest. After some time, they came to a great lake called Vaitavana. Swans, chakravaks, and other graceful birds swam in its waters, and the lake's edges were crowded with red, blue, and white lotus flowers. These were all so very fragrant, so fragrant that the air was heavy with their perfume. Numerous fruit trees loaded with golden fruits grew all around the lake. Peacocks, chakoras, cuckoos, and other birds, all singing beautiful songs, played in the trees. The brothers also saw many siddhas and charanas sporting in the woods and on the lake shore, and numberless rishis sitting motionless at the water's edge, their minds fixed on the Supreme Brahman. Yudhishthir was delighted. The area was so beautiful. They would live here. The brothers rested beneath a large banyan tree, looking like five great elephants sitting by the side of a mountain. Daumya then performed sacred rituals to sanctify the place where they would build their cottages, and then they began construction. Living in that forest, the Pandavas resembled a number of Indras amid the celestials. They served the rishis and Brahmins by offering them excellent fruits and roots. Daumya and other priests would perform daily sacrificial rites in honor of the gods and the Pandavas' ancestors. They thought constantly of Krishna and passed their time hearing the Brahmanas recite Vedic texts. Soon after their arrival at Vaitavana, the ageless Rishi Markandeya visited them. It was said that Markandeya had lived since the dawn of creation and that he knew of everything that had occurred in the history of the universe. Markandeya greeted the Pandavas with affection and accepted their worship. The Rishi, whose body was effulgent with spiritual light, and who appeared to be like a youth of 16 years, smiled to see them. They reminded him of Ram and Lakshman, who had been exiled to the forest hundreds of thousands of years previous. The sage had also visited them. Since arriving in the forest, Yudhishthira had felt grief at what he had caused, and that grief was beginning to engulf him. Seeing Markandeya smiling, Yudhishthira asked, "O illustrious one, all these ascetics here are sorry to see our plight. How is it that you alone smile with delight?" "I am not delighted, my child. Rather, I am amazed at how much your situation resembles the life of Dasharatha's son Ram. He too suffered due to his unfailing truthfulness, and he too lived in the forest exiled for some years. I remember seeing him thousands of years ago wandering Mount Rishyamukha with his bow. Like you, Lord Ram was high-souled and innocent, and like you, Lord Ram lived in the forest out of filial obedience to his father. This is why I'm smiling. No matter how powerful each of us may be, we cannot avoid the calamities that arrive through destiny. No one, therefore, should ever act unrighteously, thinking, 'I am powerful.'" Markandeya then assured Yudhishthira that like Ram, he too would regain his kingdom from the Kauravas. When his period of exile was over, after promising to come again while they were in the forest, Markandeya Rishi headed north. Part 6. Yudhishthira's Mixed Feelings in Dvaitavana. While the Pandavas dwelt at Dvaitavana, the air was constantly filled with the sounds of Vedic recitations. The entire region was as holy as the abode of Lord Brahma. The sounds of mantras from the Yajur Rig and Samavedas, charming and delightful to the mind, were mingled with the twang of the Pandavas' bowstrings. They honed their martial skills by hunting dangerous forest animals, and in accordance with scriptural codes, they maintained the population of tigers, boar, buffaloes, and other beasts in the Kamyaka forest, protecting the rishis from attack. As they engaged in meditation and sacrifice, Yudhishthira loved the company of brahmanas. Now that they lived in their midst, his mind felt serene and his grief dissipated. All the world's greatest rishis had come to Dvaitavana to be with him. Narada, Vyas, Vasishtha, Bhrigu, Angira, Kashyapa, and others, they all worship Yudhishthira, just as the celestial sages worship Indra in heaven. Yudhishthira also returned their worship and spent his time discussing with them spiritual topics. Yudhishthira was actually starting to enjoy forest life. In many ways, he found it preferable to the onerous and often harsh duties of being a king. The gentle son of Dharma was happy to live a simple life of spirituality. But he always kept in mind his God-given duty as a Kshatriya. That responsibility could not be whimsically abandoned, even if unpleasant. For one's duty must always be done for the Lord's pleasure. It was thus with mixed feelings that Yudhishthira dwelt in the forest, awaiting the day when he could again resume his duties as ruler. Part 7. Draupadi cries out to Yudhishthira. Draupadi, however, was still sorrowful. She found the course of events that led up to their exile difficult, and she burned with humiliation. She burned that she had received humiliation at Duryodhan's hands. Sitting alone one evening with Yudhishthira, Draupadi revealed her feelings. O King, when I think of the wicked Duryodhan and his followers living happily in Hastinapur, and after having sent you to the forest, my heart burns. Without doubt, he is delighting in our misfortune. When you set out for the forest, all the Kurus cried, except for the wretched Duryodhan, Karna, Shakuni, and that vicious Dushasan. Draupadi again found herself weeping. She remembered her parting words with Kunti and Gandhari. Both of them had grieved at her humiliation. How long would it be before she was avenged and the wrongdoers punished? Seeing you seated here on this grass mat, remembering your ivory throne crusted with jewels, I feel such anguish that I can hardly look at you. Your body is smeared with mud from the riverbank, when it once was daubed with the finest sandalwood paste. You once wore costly silk garments. Now you wear deer skins and tree bark. How can I bear to see my other husbands, who were once waited upon by numerous servants, and now scouring the forest for food? Draupadi's sorrow suddenly turned to anger. All this is due to the evil schemes of sinful men. O King, does your plight not arouse anger in you? Why are you so peaceful? Look at Bhima, glancing at you again and again. Constrained only by his love for you, he does not rise up and destroy the Kauravas. Honoring your promise, he sits containing his anger. Look also at Arjuna. He understands Bhima's mind and is forever pacifying him. By the power of Arjuna's bow, thousands of kings were obliged to wait upon the Brahmins at your Rajasuya sacrifice. Now that same Arjuna has become grief-stricken. Does this not make you angry? And look at Madri's youthful sons. They are as dear to you as they are to your mother, Kunti. Now they are forced to live the hard life of an ascetic. Does this not make you angry? I cannot understand why you have not risen up to destroy the Kauravas. Surely, after all that has happened, such a response would be in accord with morality. Is your discrimination failing you? It is always appropriate for a Kshatriya to show anger when sin is committed, and sin has surely been committed by the Kauravas. How can you sit here as if you forgive them? If the king cannot distinguish between the time to be angry and the time to forgive, then that king is lost. I also know the scripture. Scripture states that Duryodhan and his brothers deserve to be punished. Scripture also states that the humble and the ever-forgiving person is always neglected, while one who is powerful and assails others at the proper time is respected as a king. Part 8. Anger, the second gateway to hell. Yudhishthir looked with compassion upon his beautiful wife. She had suffered so much, and if anything stirred his heart, it was Draupadi's suffering, for which he felt he had been the cause. Yes, his heart still burned when he thought how she was dragged into the assembly hall. The pain of that moment would stay with him for the rest of his life. But this was not the time to make war. Draupadi could not understand the entire situation. Yudhishthir replied gently, "Oh, intelligent lady, through anger we may sometimes gain wealth, but anger ultimately destroys mankind. Real prosperity crowns one who conquers anger and brings adversity to one whom anger controls. Anger is the root of all destruction. An angry man commits sin blindly. An angry man will kill even his preceptor and insult his elders. Such a person cannot distinguish between right and wrong. There is nothing an angry man may not do or say, even to the point of sending himself to death's abode. Knowing this, I will not indulge in anger, Draupadi. Rather, I will strive to control it." Part 9. The Beauty of Forgiveness. Draupadi listened respectfully. She knew her husband's grasp of religion and morality was unsurpassed. He was capable of instructing even the gods. Sitting on a simple mat of kusha grass, Yudhishthir continued. When a weak man is oppressed by one more powerful, he should not display anger, lest he bring about his own destruction. There are no blessed regions in the hereafter for those who destroy themselves. Thus the weak should always control their anger. Only fools praise anger, considering it equivalent to energy. The wise keep anger at a distance. The man consumed by anger does not easily acquire generosity, dignity, courage, skill, or the other attributes possessed of men of character. The wise consider one a man of character who restrains his wrath. The pious always praise such a man because they understand that a forgiving man is always victorious. One who represses his or her anger, even when antagonized, rejoices in the next world. Because of this, it is said that a wise man, whether strong or weak, and even if in difficulty, should always forgive his persecutor. By now, Yudhishthir's brothers had gathered and were listening. Yudhishthir went on describing the glories of forgiveness. If there were not persons in this world who exercise forgiveness, then chaos would soon prevail. If kings and other superiors give way to anger, then distressed people would quickly meet with ruin. If inferiors do not tolerate their superiors' admonishments, then sin will take root and destroy mankind. I shall now cite to you the verse spoken in ancient times by the Rishi Kashyapa. Forgiveness is virtue. Forgiveness is sacrifice. Forgiveness is the Vedas. Forgiveness is purity and penance. Forgiveness is truth, piety, religion, and the holy Narayan. Thus forgiveness, and by forgiveness, the universe is sustained. Practicing forgiveness, one can attain to everlasting regions of bliss. How then can I renounce forgiveness, O Draupadi? In forgiveness is established spirituality, truth, wisdom, and the three worlds. Both this world and the next belong to the forgiving person. Therefore, forgiveness is considered the highest virtue. Yudhishthir smiled at his wife. Bhishma, Drona, Vidura, Kripa, and the other Kuru elders all desire peace. Vyasadeva and the other rishis also praise peace, Panchali. Therefore, let us first try for a peaceful settlement. If Dhritarashtra yields to temptation and does not return our kingdom, then the Bharata race will be destroyed. But let me not be the cause, O princess. forgiveness and humility, both of which are unknown to Duryodhan, are the qualities of the self-controlled. They constitute eternal virtue. I shall therefore adopt them. Part 10. Draupadi and her faith challenged. Draupadi was still doubtful. If virtue conferred victory and success on a man, then how could Yudhisthira have undergone such a calamity? He had never strayed from virtue at any time. Even during the gambling match, he acted only with virtuous intentions. But now he was cast into misfortune. And meanwhile, the sinful Duryodhan enjoyed prosperity. Thus the princess questioned. It seems to me, O king, that although you always protect virtue, virtue has not protected you. Why, even the celestials know that you live only by virtue. I am sure you would abandon me and your brothers before abandoning virtue. You serve the Brahmins with everything you possess. You never disregard your elders, equals, or even inferiors. Although you conquered the earth, you did not become proud. You have performed great sacrifices and have given unlimited charity. Why, even now, while living a life of hardship in this forest, your virtue has suffered no diminishment. Draupadi looked at her husband in the eyes as she made her point. Despite all this, still your intelligence was perverted by destiny and you gambled everything away. Your wealth, kingdom, brothers, you even gambled me. How could one like you, so simple, gentle, honest, liberal, modest, and truthful, how could you be drawn to gambling? Gambling is a vice. I just cannot understand how all of this is possible. Although Draupadi understood that everything was under the control of the Supreme Lord, she felt her faith had been challenged. It was challenged by Yudhisthira's seemingly inexplicable situation. Surely, O King, all creatures are made to act by the Lord, even as a puppet is moved by its controller. No one can pass a moment independently. God ordains our happiness and distress in accord with the results of our past actions. Everyone depends upon the Lord. He brings us together and uses us as instruments to fulfill each other's karma. It thus seems to me that it is the Lord who has brought about your calamity. But how has he sanctioned such injustice? Injustice so contrary to the ways of virtue and truth. If God is not to blame, then it means that the controlling principle is the one who has the most power. If actions are not bound with God-given consequences, then I lament for those who are not powerful. Part 11. Do not doubt virtue just because you do not see its results. Yudhishthir could see that his wife was bewildered by grief and sorrow. O gentle lady born from sacrifice, although your speech is sweet and well articulated, it is atheistic. No one should ever perform virtue with a desire to gain its fruits. Such a sinful traitor of virtue will never reap the results. I practice virtue only because I desire to follow the Vedas and satisfy the Lord. The Vedas state that one who doubts virtue is destined to be born among the low-class brutes. One who doubts religion, virtue, and the words of the rishis is excluded from the regions of immortality and bliss. Such a person is considered lower than a thief. Draupadi bowed her head as her husband continued. O thin-waisted lady, you have seen with your own eyes the results of virtue in such immortal sages as Markandeya, Vyasadeva, Maitreya, and the celestial sage Narada. All these shining and ever-blissful rishis describe virtue as the foremost duty. If the pieties practiced by the virtuous bore no fruits, then this world would long ago have been covered by darkness. No one would have pursued liberation, nor cared to acquire knowledge or even wealth. All men would have lived like beasts, and the world would have been thrown into confusion. The brahmanas, who had by now also come to hear Yudhishthir's speech, nodded in agreement. By now darkness had set in, and fires burned in the great clearing where they sat. Draupadi could hear the flames crackling, as well as the sounds of crickets, as Yudhishthir continued to speak to her. Do not doubt virtue just because you do not see its results. Without doubt, their fruits will manifest in time, O Panchali, as will the fruits of sin. The fruits of true virtue are eternal and indestructible, leading one to the highest regions of happiness. Therefore, do not speak ill of God. Try to understand that Supreme Being and His desires. O Draupadi, always bow to God, for this will be for your own good. Part 12. Draupadi's doubt about inaction. Tears now fell from Draupadi's eyes. She knew her husband's words were true. Surely God was infallible and always the well-wishing friend of all living beings. But who could understand God? His activities were inscrutable. No one can understand his plans. The apparent reversal of the virtuous Pandavas, and even more so, that the reversal had seemingly come through Yudhishthir's own inexplicable actions. Why, all of this was incomprehensible and quite incredible. Draupadi sighed. I accept what you have said, O best of men. The Lord is certainly bestowing upon all beings the fruits of their own work. Even if some sudden calamity or good fortune befalls us, we must understand it to be the result of some action in a former life. But besides destiny, there is exertion. A man who does not exert himself will eventually be ruined. I feel you should exert yourself now to recover your kingdom. Even if you fail, you will at least have satisfied everyone that you did all that human endeavor can accomplish. Although the results are not in our hands, we should still perform our work. The wise always condemn inaction. Why then do you remain inactive? This is my doubt. Part 13. Bhima states his case for battle. Draupadi fell silent. Now stirred by her words, Bhima felt impelled to speak. He too was angry and found the forest almost unbearable. It was not the austerity he minded, but the thought of Duryodhan and his brothers enjoying their ill-gotten gains. Why did Yudhisthira suffer in silence? Draupadi was right. It was time for them to act. Bhima burst out. Oh, Yudhisthira, what do you hope to gain by living like an ascetic? You are not a yogi. You are a king. You should walk the path of kings. Duryodhan robbed you and your kingdom. That Duryodhan is like a weak, offal-eating jackal stealing the prey of lions. How do you tolerate it? How can you abandon the wealth that was both our source of virtue and pleasure in exchange for this trifling virtue called keeping your promise? Surely you fail to see what is of true value. But Yudhisthira remained calm. While Bhima vented his long pent-up anger, the forest reverberated with Bhima's words. His voice was as deep and powerful as a kettle drum. O king, my brother, it was only due to your carelessness that we lost our kingdom. Only to please you did we allow Duryodhan and his brothers to wrest from us our wealth and afflict us with such pain. Why, on your command, we now pain our friends and enliven our enemies. Surely it was folly that we did not kill the Kauravas then and there. No, instead, we have meekly come to the forest, an act worthy only of weak, impotent men. Why, even Krishna does not approve, nor does Arjuna, the twins. What to speak of myself, O king? Has your despair led you to lose your manliness on the plea of virtue? Only cowards cherish despair, being unable to win back that what they have lost. Bhima argued that so-called virtue which produced calamity, was not virtue at all. What use was virtue for its own sake? Kings should practice virtue to make their kingdoms prosperous and to achieve pleasure. All three things, virtue, profit, and pleasure, should be pursued equally. None of them should be sought at the cost of the others. Have you lost sight of your proper duty? You are a powerful warrior, supported by other powerful men. Now, use that power to regain your rightful kingdom. When you have established your rule, then you can acquire religious merit by ruling piously and giving charity to the Brahmins. By giving up this promise to stay in the forest, you will be casting aside an inferior principle for the greater good. Bhima then softened. The Brahmins and the people want you to rule them. They all despise Duryodhan. You are capable of taking back your kingdom, and you have Arjuna and myself to help you. Who can withstand us in battle? Let us use strategy and strength to win back what is ours. This is our duty. Yudhishthira remained silent for some moments as he summoned his patience. Then he looked up at Bhima. O descendant of Bharat, I cannot reproach you. Although you are giving me pain with your arrow-like words, it is true that due to my folly, I have brought this calamity upon us. I knew I could not defeat Shukuni at dice, and yet I allowed myself to be drawn into the game. I should have exerted greater control over myself. O Bhimasen, the mind cannot be controlled once it comes under the influence of manliness, pride, and prowess. I do not censure you for what you have just said, but I do consider what has happened to us to be preordained. Yudhishthira made it clear that he would not break his promise. Do you recall the conditions of the final dice game? Shukuni said, he who loses this game shall go to the forest and remain there for 13 years. The winner shall take his kingdom and return it when the forest term has expired. I then uttered, so be it. Yudhishthira hung his head and fell silent. He was remembering that fateful day. What had overcome him? He had thought he was acting only for virtue, but as a result, all his loved ones suffered. Still, he was resolute. No matter how painful their present situation, there was no turning back. He would not abandon his promise. The agreement would be kept. Yudhishthira remained firm. How then, O Bhima, shall I now falsify my word for the sake of wealth? To me, nothing is greater than truth. For a respectable person, it is better to die than to transgress his word. Let us pass our days here in peace. Better days will come. Just as a farmer scatters seeds and awaits the harvest. In the same way, virtue and truth always bring good results in time. Do not doubt this principle. Bhima, however, was not convinced. His heart was too full of anger. He had not even been able to sleep since coming to the forest. Neither could he face the prospect of waiting so many years before he could vent his rage on the Kauravas. What virtue had they ever observed? Why then should Yudhisthira treat them as honorable? Did he think they respected his virtue and adherence to truth? They saw him as weak and were laughing at him. If only Yudhisthira would see sense and order them to gear up for battle. Bhima tried again to convince his brother. O great king, how can any mortal make a promise that is dependent on the passage of time? No one knows when his or her life will end. We have now been in the forest for 13 months. Let that be our 13 years. Indeed, the Vedas state that in certain circumstances, a month can substitute for a year. Let us go now and crush our enemies. Even if we were to go to hell on that day, that hell will feel like heaven. Although only Draupadi and I have revealed our hearts to you on this matter, Arjuna, the twins, Kunti, and our many allies share the same feelings. Only because they seek to please you do they remain silent. It is only weakness that forces you to adhere to your pledge, my dear brother. No one is praising you for your kindly disposition toward our enemies. Bhima stood silhouetted by the fire. His huge frame resembled a blazing mountain. O king, although remaining fixed in virtue, you still cannot see the truth. Like an ignorant man who has memorized the Vedas without knowing their meaning. You are a Kshatriya, yet you act like a Brahmin. A king's duties are always fraught with crookedness and cunning. You know this very well. Bhima had yet another concern. How would they be able to live incognito for the 13th year? They were known throughout the world, and Duryodhan had many supporters. Numerous kings who had been subjugated by the Pandavas at the time of the Rajasuya. They all now backed the Kauravas. Duryodhan would have his spies looking for them everywhere. Bound by Yudhisthira's promise, they would be living in the forest forever. Therefore, force would be the only way out, sooner or later. Bhima implored Yudhisthira, "Please give the order for battle, O hero. There is no higher duty for a Kshatriya. If there be any sin in this course, then you can counteract it later by sacrifice and charity." Part 14. Bhima defeated by Yudhishthira's counter-arguments. Yudhishthira sighed again, but he did not speak. Bhima was overcome by passion, he thought, and he was not thinking carefully. Could he not understand that their suffering had been somehow ordained by the Supreme Lord? All they could do now was follow their religious duties as prescribed by God, leaving the results in his hands. They could not please the Lord by abandoning religion. And to please God is always everyone's prime duty. Surely Bhima knew that. But there was yet another consideration. Yudhishthira's was a calm voice as he revealed his mind to Bhima. O mighty armed hero, when a man performs sinful deeds depending upon his own power, such deeds become only a source of pain for him. But if he reflects carefully before action, then he attains success. Listen as I tell you what is likely to happen if we follow your suggestion, born as it is out of pride and mental unrest. Yudhishthira then listed the many kings allied with Duryodhan. First, there was Bhishma, Drona, and Kripa. Out of obligation, they would certainly side with Duryodhan. Then there was Ashwatthama, Karna, Palika, Burishriva, and all of Duryodhan's brothers. There were hundreds of other kings, and they would all fight alongside the Kauravas because they had been previously defeated by the Pandavas. Duryodhan's treasury was full, especially as he now had control over Indraprastha. Duryodhan could easily and quickly amass a vast army. On the other hand, the Pandavas had no position, no wealth, no army, and only a few allies. Duryodhan's forces are virtually unassailable. The Kuru chiefs are masters of the celestial weapons. I doubt that even Indra and all the gods could vanquish them. And I especially fear Karna, who is impetuous, angry, invincible, accomplished in every weapon, and encased in impenetrable armor. Yudhishthira remembered how Karna had been born with a natural coat of armor on his body. Although he appeared to be a charioteer's son, it was obvious that Karna's origin was in some way divine. For some reason, Karna harbored a deep envy of Arjuna. One day, Yudhishthira knew, Karna and Arjuna would wage a great battle to settle their enmity. The skirmish at Draupadi Svayamvara had been nothing. Karna had not wanted to exert himself against what he thought was a Brahmin. But if Karna had displayed his full power, then who could be sure that Arjuna would be able to defeat him? Thinking of Karna and the danger he possesses, I cannot sleep at night, O brother. Without overcoming him, as well as the other heroes I have mentioned, we will not be able to defeat Duryodhan. O best of men, consider all of this very carefully. Hearing his brother's admonition, Bhima became pensive. Yudhishthira was right, of course, and he could not argue with him. Although Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, and the other kings in Hastinapur had always been their friends and well-wishers, it was now different. When it came to war, they would surely side with the Kauravas. The thought of fighting against those invincible heroes was daunting, especially because he felt so much affection for them. Bhima sat down, defeated. Chapter 24, Final Part. Vyasadeva soothes Yudhishthira's mental fever. As the Pandavas sat together in silence, Vyasadeva suddenly appeared out of the forest. They quickly stood up and bowed before the Rishi. After taking a seat amongst them, Vyasadeva said to Yudhishthira, "O mighty armed one, I have divined your thoughts. I wish to help you, therefore I have come. I will destroy the fever in your mind by telling you how to defeat Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, Karna, Duryodhan, and all his followers. Listen carefully." Vyasadeva then took Yudhishthira aside and spoke to him in private. He taught him the mystical skill called Pratismriti. Then he instructed him to teach the same skill to Arjuna. This skill allowed the practitioner to travel great distances in a short time. Arjuna should thus go to the Himalayas. He should approach the demigods, and he should receive from them all their special weapons. Due to his asceticism and prowess, Arjuna is quite capable of approaching the celestials. Indeed, Arjuna is Narayan's eternal associate. Indra, Rudra, and all the principal demigods will surely bestow their weapons upon Arjuna, and thus he will perform tremendous deeds upon receiving them. After giving Yudhishthira the Pratismriti mantras, Vyasadeva left. Just before leaving, he told Yudhishthira to move to a different forest. Otherwise, the brothers might disturb the animal population in the Dvaitavana by hunting them excessively. Having lived there more than a year, they had killed many deer, tigers, boar, and other wild animals. Accompanied by the Brahmins whom they were supporting, Yudhishthira and his brothers moved to another part of the great Kamyaka forest, this time on the banks of the river Sarasvati.